Serving Asheville and Buncombe County since 1974, Asheville Greenworks is a nonprofit urban environment conservation organization working to enhance the community through educational and volunteer-based environmental programs. With thousands of volunteers, they engage the community in grassroots projects such as planting trees, urban agriculture, environmental cleanups, anti-litter and waste reduction education, creation and maintenance of green spaces, playground enhancement and preservation of Asheville's rivers and trees. To volunteer or make donations, please contact them at ashevillegreenworks.org or call them at 828-254-1776. The views expressed on the Final Straw Radio do not necessarily reflect those of Asheville FM, Friends of Community Radio, or any of the affiliate radio stations airing this show.
You're listening to WSFM LP 103.3 in Asheville, North Carolina. This is The Final Straw, and I'm William Goodenough.
And I'm Bruce Goodness.
The show can also be heard on KXCF in Marshall, California, KWTF in Bodega Bay, California, KOWA LP in Olympia, Washington, and WCRS LP in Columbus, Ohio. The show will later be archived at thefinalstrawradio.noblogs.org, and you can email us with questions or suggestions at thefinalstrawradio@riseup.net. If you care to, you can send us letters at The Final Straw, care of Asheville FM, 864 Haywood Road, Asheville, North Carolina, 28806. The show is brought to you by Firestorm Books and Coffee. Located at 610 Haywood Road, Firestorm Books and Coffee is a worker-owned cooperative in Asheville specializing in offbeat, underground, and independent literature. Firestorm's full catalog of books and zines can be found online at firestorm.coop.
The Final Straw is still soliciting artwork to put onto tote bags, t-shirts, stickers, small dogs, and more things. If you have an idea or an image, send a link to the Final Straw Radio at riseup.net. Also, our show is free to stream and download. If there's a pirate broadcast or community radio station in your area that you'd like to hear us playing on, shoot us an email at thefinalstrawradio@riseup.net, and we can look into helping to get us onto your local airwaves.
This week, we are happy to share an interview contributed by an audio militant associated with The Final Straw. This conversation took place after one of the presentations of the Crime Think Tour associated with the publishing and distribution of To Change Everything zine, a recent and widely translated introduction and invitation to anarchy. This interview was conducted shortly after one of the three panel discussions that took place last month in the Bay Area and includes two members of the tour. Sasha is an anarchist from Prague in the Czech Republic, and Ramona is an anarchist from Slovenia. The Crime Think To Change Everything tour will be hitting up Firestorm Books and Coffee in Asheville, North Carolina on Wednesday, November 11th at 5 p.m. If you like the insights you hear on this conversation and want to engage these guests plus more, show up to this free event.
Next week, we'll be bringing an interview between our own William Goodenough and members of the No New Animal Labs Initiative, attempting to organize against the planned building of an expanded public/private animal testing facility on the University of Washington campus.
But first, a couple of announcements.
Asheville FM is an oasis of diversity amid the sameness of the commercial media landscape. Tired of hearing the same songs over and over across the radio dial? Asheville FM spins over 3,000 different songs each month on 103.3 in Asheville, providing essential nourishment for your mind and soul. Community radio exists only so long as the people who choose to listen also choose to help pay for it. Support Asheville FM right now when you go to ashevillefm.org and click the donate button. Or call 828-259-3936 today.
If you appreciate The Final Straw and want to make a donation to Asheville FM, please mention our show in the memo of your donation. $1 to $100 or whatever, no donation is too small.
From the YouCaring.com fundraising page for our friend Steph, quote, on October 19th, while attempting to help a man whose dog had been hit by a car, Stephanie Wilson was run over by an SUV. The accident left her with life-threatening injuries and claimed the life of the dog she was attempting to help. The man she was with also injured, though less severely. For anyone who knows Steph, they know that her being injured while attempting to help others is an emblematic example of her unceasing willingness to put the lives of others before herself. Over the years, Steph has rescued countless animals, often traveling to disaster areas to volunteer as a relief worker, and has never hesitated to help someone in need. Just last week, she was rescuing animals from the flooding in South Carolina. But now, this ceaseless champion of others needs your help, unquote. Please consider donating to help get Steph back on her feet and support the animals currently under her care. If you can't personally afford to donate, please pass this campaign along to your friends. All money raised will go towards Steph's long-term recovery, rehabilitation, and immediate costs of animal care for the animals currently in her rescue. To find out more and to contribute to fundraising for Steph Wilson's medical costs, search Stephanie Wilson on youcaring.com.
Unstoppable is specifically by and for incarcerated folk who identify as women, gender variant, and or trans. This anti-authoritarian publication seeks to blend radical political analysis with personal experiences and observations. They want to elevate the voices on the inside that are often excluded from political dialogue, while also asking people on the outside to convey their social and political realities to people on the inside. Unstoppable aims to build bridges across prison walls and beyond them by facilitating dialogue and engagement between those who are incarcerated and those who are not. Unstoppable is asking for contributions in the form of artwork, poetry, writings, social commentary, field notes from the prison yard or the streets, critical views of power structures, and more. Unstoppable is particularly interested in focusing on gendered issues and systems of social control in the U.S. context, but they invite a wide array of topics. You can contact Unstoppable Publication at gmail.com. That's unstoppablepublication.com, one word, if you wish to be involved with this project in any way, or if you have a contribution to share. Or you can write them at Unstoppable, P.O. Box 11032, Pueblo, Colorado 81001 to contribute or to get a free subscription. If you're currently incarcerated, you can get a free subscription. Please spread the word to folks on the outside and the inside. They want this distributed broadly.
We're joined here today with two people from the Crime Think Tour to Change Everything. So I was just hoping if you all could just tell us a little bit about yourselves and where you're from and what project you're involved with.
Hi, thank you for inviting us. My name is Sasha. I'll maybe start with reacting what you said. We had just long discussion actually yesterday about how much is this tour Crime Think or not. So just to clarify that not all of us would identify ourselves with this label as being Crime Think, though Crime Think definitely has an important role in planning and kicking off this To Change Everything project. But it's not a part of Crime Think project. Me personally, I'm coming from Prague, which is in Czech Republic, that's Central Eastern Europe. Politically, this post-Eastern Europe, you know, in the, what used to be the Eastern Bloc. And I'm personally involved in anti-repression movement and supporting prisoners movement, like ABC, and in Czech, this thing called Anti-Phoenix, because there was this police repression called Operation Phoenix, which is Phoenix in English, so that's what I've been doing mostly.
Hi, my name is Ramona. I'm from Slovenia. I am involved there in different projects. We have an anarchist network that extends through Slovenia and Croatia. I am also part of InfoShop that is located in a squad called Metilko, which just celebrated its 22nd anniversary of being independent. I have been involved in different struggles from anti-fascist to different occupation student solidarity struggles, and one of the things that really kind of marked my involvement in anarchist politics was definitely my involvement in the uprising that we had a few years ago, and also that is basically something that I have been extensively talking about on the tour. Otherwise, we were one of the more than 27 crews around the globe that translated and worked before that on the text To Change Everything. We are also a part of this Crime Think tour.
Cool. I just wanted to ask you both as far as your intention with going on this, because I know obviously, I mean, you all have lives where you're from, you're involved in stuff, and you have to feed and support yourselves. I mean, what did you want to come out of this by coming all the way to the United States and all these places and doing this tour? What do you hope that people take away from these events? And also, like, what do you want to take away? And in the end, all of us as anarchists become stronger?
I think that we have been seeing in the last, at least since 2008, but probably even before, a series of uprisings all over the world. And the geography of struggle is seriously changing. It is no longer as it was in the anti-globalization struggles, where activists were in the front rows of those struggles. Now we are increasingly entering the terrain of struggle that is fronted by the most people who are most targeted in our society. So the question for all of us is then, how are we going to react on those struggles? And also, in those uprisings, we have been seeing how those uprisings very quickly change if there is not a significant presence of radical politics, how the tactics that we are using get increasingly co-opted by fascists, by the state, by parties, and so on. So all of that brings us alongside, at least personally for me, with the huge destabilization of peripheries of Europe in terms of war and simple unrest. All of this brings a question: what are we as anarchists going to do? And I think that it's no longer time to search for those questions in our localized groups, but rather to engage in international, if not intercontinental, dialogue about the strategies that we employ as anarchists in our struggles. So this is basically the reason behind this tour and my involvement. I understand To Change Everything as a tool, as a first step of a dialogue with our comrades, and I am hoping that by reaching out to the community of friends that, you know, we are perhaps not so much in contact otherwise here in US, that we will simply learn and continue to learn about their struggles, about their strategies, about their failures and limitations that they have reached, and of course also about their victories. So this is basically my hope, that we kind of have like a mutual dialogue and mutual growth in our ideas and strength, and that we simply take our political project seriously and seriously also engage into the question, what do we want to do?
To me, besides, I definitely agree with all what Ramona just had said. To me as well, I figure out that not only, you know, arms, bombs and capital and Hollywood and all these things is being known from USA all over the world, but as well, your uprisings, you know, like when Ferguson happens, when Baltimore happens, and then things when Green Scare is happening, everyone knows about that. We all talk about it. We all read about it. But I see that it's not the same the other way around. You know, that here in, if something happens where I'm from, or in Slovenia, or even in Brazil, which is a pretty big country, no one talks about that here. So that's, to me, one of the reasons why to spread some information. Not from a point of view that I would like to represent the country I'm from. Hell no. Yeah. But more like, see that we are involved in very similar struggles, and we're facing the same enemies and the same structures of oppression as people face in here. And not to tell them like, hey, you got to fight for us, but sometimes to show that, how to say, not taking action here against, you know, like some tool of oppression might actually have big impact on us, which people very often might not know. And then to me, another thing is, you know, to create bigger network, like people who have discussion together and staying in touch and just like comparing notes, which is very important to me, and learning. Like, we've been talking every night, but to me, what I got to say, I'm usually speaking about militarization, police repression, racism and nationalism, and I know all of that by heart and like being in touch with peeps at home, but I like to listen how it refers to the struggles here and get inspired by people who are very often much older or from more targeted communities than I am, and bringing these inspirations back home to get, you know, to get stronger and smarter from what I got to hear in USA, and try to apply it somehow in my struggle back in Czech Republic.
Okay, that's great. Yeah, there's a lot that you brought up, both, that I want to come back to later, but just to kind of keep this conversation going, you know, one of the things that you were bringing up last night at the talk in Oakland was that, one of the things that I often think about is that how a lot of these revolts kind of choke off, as they say in the book, to our friends at the riot stage, and they don't kind of expand beyond that. It's kind of like this real burst of energy. Stuff gets burned down. The police are attacked. Like you brought up Ferguson, you know, there was armed conflicts between the people in the communities and the police with guns and stuff, which doesn't often happen in the U.S. or hasn't happened for several decades. So I'm curious if you all have an idea about how anarchists should, at least in theory, start to take these revolts beyond just kind of like this real big burst of anger, which often, in my experience, just leads for a politician often to come in and just say like, oh, people are angry, here's the solution. And then
I think that one of the things that we have to kind of accept, and it's maybe not the easiest thing to accept, because whenever we are involved in struggle, we want it to end, to last forever. And, you know, we want that energy, to keep that energy going. But I think that one of the things that we simply have to understand is that movements have their own cycle of life. And I think that one of the biggest mistakes that we make is that when the moment of the movement is gone, we still try to keep them alive. As if, you know, like trying to keep the corpse alive somehow. And I think that this is a moment where we make most mistakes. First of all, we are usually left alone and radicalized, where society is no longer around us, you know, to support our actions. And that leads to being targeted with the repression. And that usually ends with years of solidarity struggles, just focusing on prisoners and so on. And we simply don't have any energy or time left to do anything else. Second of all, I think that this is also a time where a lot of conflicts emerge. And a lot of energy gets thrown away into burnout, and so on. And we have been seeing this repeatedly during Occupy, during uprisings, and during basically every kind of struggle. I think that one of the things that we have to understand is that we will not be continuing our struggles in a linear way where either, you know, one struggle will last forever or every next one will be bigger, better, you know, more militant and so on. We just have to understand those moments as moments of break. And so for me, the most important thing is, are we coming out of those moments when energy is high, stronger than we went in or not? Because I think we have to find ways in which we come out of them stronger. And what I mean by stronger is, one, we demonstrate patterns how to revolt. You know, and our friend yesterday, you know, talked about how there is a trajectory in US, for instance, which is really interesting for me, that, you know, during the here in Oakland, in 2009, I think, you know, people demonstrated occupations and like did some relatively, you know, things that were later on, you know, when the student occupations happened, just basically no one was thinking about blockading, as I understand. But then, you know, when Black Lives Matter happened, like everyone is blockading, and, you know, and just how these militant tactics are actually perhaps not so much relevant in that moment, but can be relevant in moments that are yet to come when people reflect on them. And then it seems like, I don't know, I remember that in our uprising, you know, for people it was very hard to think in the beginning that they will take and blockade the streets. You know, now a tiny little protest that is even organized by like some official, you know, people or something like that is happening by blockade. You know, this has become a standard. So sometimes our task is in those moments of high energy to push the standards forward. Second thing that I think makes us stronger, or what I understand as being stronger, is, you know, do we ask ourselves, you know, in a situation where we are surrounded by much more people than we usually meet in our spaces, you know, do we ask, hey, where are we going to meet again? You know, who are you? And I'm not saying that sometimes the riot situation is the best situation to have like an easy going conversation, but I think that realistically, you know, those moments of rioting usually last at least for a few days or a few weeks, and that there is some time, you know, in which you can bond. In which you can bond and build strength in our community. And also, I think that if we think about the situation of high energy and rioting and so on, we have to ask ourselves, what did we do before that? And that is probably one of the most important things. Have we created ties in our community? Have we created spaces in which we can meet in our community? I think those things are sometimes crucial for the situation to expand, because when we are in that situation, I know that when we were in uprising, we simply didn't have time to produce material, to think about things, you know, to have meetings. It was just like a whole bunch of things happening. And so all the work that we did before, you know, either in terms of anti-fascist struggle, you know, or something like that, became crucial. Because, for instance, to just say that example, when fascists in the first riot appeared in the crowd, it wasn't us who had to throw them out. It was the whole community of people there that extended much beyond anarchist community that, you know, that basically pushed those people out. And I think that's usually what I mean by how are we preparing? Are we having those conversations? What we will do when that moment arrives? Because that those moments will come, and they always come. Yeah. The question is only like will we understand them as also our moments, as our space of struggle, or will we sit back and wait what's going to happen? And I think that's probably also what makes us feel stronger or less strong. You know, are we confused when Occupy happens, or do we go in full strength? You know, are we confused when Ferguson happens, you know, and don't know how to act, or we go there full strength, taking risk, no compromise?
I think there is as well important fact, and that is like, you know, blockading highways, blockading port, running around the streets, burning police cars, or even as you said, like, you know, bringing firearms and shooting around. It's all like enjoyable and very important, but no one wants to do it all the time. You know, like none of us wants to stay on a highway. It's like, we're not losing if we leave the highway after a week or 2 days or 2 months, because who of us wants to spend the rest of the life on standing on a highway, right? But I think that moment, what we're creating there is important to take to our everyday, more, let's say, like sustainable life, you know, to our everyday life. So I think those spaces we open there, and not just for us, but make sure how we open them for everyone, for more targeted communities, and like being inclusive in those spaces, just thinking how to transform these spaces in beyond the riot and make it this like everyday revolution. These relationships, which are alternative to capitalism and the you know, state control relationship, bring them to our homes, to our neighborhoods, to the streets.
I think that kind of leads me to my next question. And this is, again, something that you all brought up last night with like this idea of infrastructure, which everybody talks about. And it was surprising for me to hear from somebody else that was on the tour saying, like, in the U.S., like, there's so much infrastructure, there's spaces. And somebody else was saying, well, yeah, that's true when you're driving like 3 hours to get from place to place. But I feel like here one of our problems is we have a lot of stuff, but we don't necessarily have the ties in the community to actually bring people that would create the kind of social bonds that when an uprising happens, that, you know, we can use that to our advantage. So I was curious if maybe you could elaborate either in your experience or your estimation, like how do you think an infrastructure or types of infrastructure could be used for the types of things that we're talking about? Or at least what are the things that you're trying to build back where you're from that you don't have right now?
I actually, comparing where I'm from and being here for now 6 weeks, almost like besides today and 2 days ago, nonstop seeing spaces, seeing people, having very intensive social and political life, I actually feel that here is a lot of potential. And it's even better to hear that people say that it's not good, because, you know, right, to see the high horizons is always good than be like, hey, we got a lot of literature, we got a lot of spaces, so we good. I think it's great that with all you guys have and already built, still not seen it as enough. That's really good. I like to see that. But if I compare with where I'm from, or this maybe what you are saying comes from comment of our Brazilian comrade who is with us on tour, as he usually says, you know, here in first week on this tour, I've seen more radical spaces than I've seen in my entire life in Brazil. You know, and I feel especially connection here with people who would not label themselves as anarchists, but being like comrades or being on the same boat or being, you know, on our side when it comes to breakdown, it's much better than where I'm coming from. So for me, I'm much more talking about these questions, much more getting inspirations here than having tips how to improve the situation in US.
Me coming from, you know, a squat and a town that actually like has even a bigger squat, even though ours is huge, you know, because it's like a squatted complex of former military ground barracks. But having a lot of this infrastructure in terms of space, and not just in our city, but all over the country, the questions that are raised for me in this context, and maybe this is relevant for US context as well, is how do we use those spaces? You know, do we take those infrastructure as just a goal, you know, something that has to exist, and then all our energy goes into maintaining that infrastructure and, you know, deciding what it is that needs to be done with it, and like focusing on having a cultural or whatever, or even political kind of program in it, or a social program in it? Or do we understand those spaces as spaces of empowerment, with which, you know, just a tool of our confrontational politics. And I think that I want to think, and I am admitting that not always where I come from we think like that, but it's what we should, I think, inspire for, is to basically understand ourselves not as a secluded bubble of freedom where all the relationships are good and everything can be questioned, and, you know, and then we just build like this separate community there, but rather understand that our infrastructure has to serve to our struggle, and has to serve to our struggle as being, one, the space where people can get together and think, a space where younger generations perhaps can be radicalized, or not just younger, let's not be ages, you know, like where people can get in touch, for instance, with some ideas, with some literature, with different, as you said, different kinds of relationships, you know, being an example, if you want, of a different kind of society, but not being secluded. I think that whenever we were experiencing a situation where a community has lost space in Slovenia, we have seen the decline of radical politics. And I think this is simply a lot to do with the fact that people simply don't have anymore the place where they would meet, where they could brainstorm ideas, where they could meet people who think differently. So I think that in that sense, this kind of infrastructure is important. But infrastructure shouldn't be understood solely as a concrete space, you know, a concrete building. I think this can extend to, you know, an open space, like, I don't know, squatted parks, squatted community gardens or something like that. Or it can only extend even to social relations that we want. Sometimes we don't have to be localized in a space in order to make that kind of infrastructure. We can have, be very fluid in what we understand as infrastructure in our communities, in our neighborhoods. But I think the most important thing is that we don't rely on some kind of bureaucratic organization to take things or do things instead of us, because it doesn't matter how we bureaucratize our life. You know, how many meetings do we hold in a space about what we want to do in the space if we don't check in with each other what it is that we truly want, who we are, you know, how do we feel? And I think that's also important.
I see there an important thing when we're building this infrastructure, and to me is this distinction between like the how open we want to be versus how radical position anarchist ground we want to stay on. And I think this is, to me, very important, try to combine these two things, like not to be exclusive, but at the same time, yes, be open, but not for a price that we would forget our ground, you know, that we would try to be somebody else just to be more popular, just to sell ourselves better, because then we're getting into waters when we can have like hundreds of people come into our spaces, thousands and thousands of social media likes, but for what, you know, realizing that the people like us because we say the nice things, but we actually not saying the things we think anymore, you know. So for me, like, it's important with this being open, still think if we are subversive and if we are like antagonistic against the structures of state and capital and all these like forms of institutions which sometimes might feel like being friendly to us, but we always have to question if it's not just to pacify us by giving us concessions, which in especially in Europe is a big thing. Like here it doesn't seem likely at all, but in Europe there is this thing, you're squatting something and in the end it ends up as like you're getting a social center from a state, maybe somewhere else when you were wanted to squat, maybe in different district. Sometimes if you are lucky in the same place, but then, you know, there is like 10 questions which you have to, 10 tasks which you have to do every year, like having it like project by, you know, like state or European Union, and then people are like, oh great, we got this space, and then maybe not, you know, maybe it's not our space anymore, right. You know, so I think we, with being open, still have to show the people what are our politics, that we're not falling into politics of demands, politics of direct democracy, politics of, you know, asking the authorities for something, but still from very antagonistic anarchist ground.
More from our friends' conversation with Sasha and Ramona from the Crime Think to Change Everything tour after this musical break. We're about to hear Hagamos el Mal by Khmer, a band from Madrid, Spain, that'll be headlining at the Auditorium in Asheville on Friday, November 6th at 9 p.m. Khmer will be alongside Uninhabitable, Spliff, and Weak Wrists. Stop!
Yeah, and I think for me, this kind of brings up the question of what do we do in the downturn? Like when there's not fires on the streets, when people aren't fighting the police, they're not burning down government buildings, like kind of how do you keep these ideas alive? How do you stay antagonistic? How do you build? Like, how do you meet new people and like get ready for, you know, the next major contradiction, which is going to happen, you know? So I think, I mean, for me, that's a key question. I think U.S. anarchists have a hard time answering this a lot of times, especially in like big cities like Oakland, where it's like, oh, we'll just go home and wait for the next thing to happen, you know, which will happen in probably a year or something, and then we'll all be brought together.
Well, I will not pretend that I have an ultimate answer, because this is also a question, I think, for all of us where we come from. And it's probably one of the crucial questions, actually. But I think when I was speaking before, you know, that not the next moment will not be like the biggest, the strongest, and so on. You know, I think it's important that we don't wait for the perfect movement to arise, and that we keep our eyes very much open, you know, to where the points of conflict in our societies are. I think it's a bad way to kind of try to identify revolutionary subjects and then like go, oh, you are the targeted community, so let's do something together, because I think that's a very patronizing and not comradely way of approaching people and approaching these situations. On the other hand, I think that waiting for things to happen by themselves is also not an option. So on one hand, I think, yes, building infrastructures and building ties and having our project is important thing. But most importantly, I think like having a dialogue about what it means to be revolt is sometimes, you know, a thing that we should be doing. Like, I mean, I remember that when I would be, you know, speaking in Germany, like I would have to speak like in three streets, you know, that are next to each other in order to reach different anarchist communities there. And I couldn't understand why it is that I have to travel through three different spaces, you know, and not everyone joining in one space. Not that I think I am important, but I think that demonstrates how even within the anarchist community, we sometimes, you know, in times of peace, build on conflict with each other instead of conflict against, you know, the system of oppression. And don't get me wrong, I think that some conflict between us has to happen, because in times of upheavals, we often forget, you know, why there are some tasks that are, for instance, only distributed among male-bodied people, and, you know, and why, I don't know, for instance, transgender people were not, you know, were not having like a big voice in our struggles and so on. So there has to be space for those conflicts to happen. But we should probably be building our politics on autonomy and respect, and not in sectarianism, which I think is a different way of thinking. But also, maybe I would also just briefly like to share a moment from Greece, you know, where it seems maybe there's like a little bit of a similar situation than here in Oakland, where the resistance is really intensified, and like you would often have a situation of riot, you know, and a situation of struggle, and it seems that like this uprising never ends there since 2008. It just has different cycles and different phases. But, you know, there you don't only have struggle on the streets, you also have struggle in many different spaces, but people are no longer like putting a lot of anarchists are no longer putting a lot of energy into, for instance, organizing in a workspace or organizing in universities, in occupations or something like that, which was something that they did in the past a lot. But they are rather understanding those spaces where they work, where they live, where they study, as spaces where they encounter people, you know, so then when something happens, like that's their crew, you know, that's the people that they seen involved with. So I think that like spreading our ideas and talking to people in the times where when we are not on barricades is actually something that then determines what the barricades will look like.
Yeah, I think for me this is one of the questions on this tour which I am trying to get answered by all the discussions every day. I think one of the things which is important is to realize that when we feel that there is no uprising, or that the time is like calm or something, it doesn't mean that it's calm for everyone. Yeah. And then, you know, check out with neighbors or more targeted communities how they do, what are their problems, what are they fighting for or against. But not from the position of like some avant-garde to recruit them, from like this like, you know, Bolshevik socialist or whoever position like top down, we're gonna show you, but we, you know, for exchange for that, we need your voices for our politics. But more from a position of people who feel what is your problems are our problems, because that's what we're fighting against, right? We're not fighting just us to get privilege, you know? I'm like, why is this male? So like, if I'm feeling all right, it doesn't mean that we're living in freedom. So more from a position, if you're not feeling all right, or if you are, you and you're not feeling all right, I'm still not going to feel all right, because that's the world I want to fight for. Like, you know, that's for me, like the basic solidarity. And, you know, not to like wreck you them, but more, or like try to get them in your revolution, but people are already raged, you know, people are already angry. And as well, working with them, solving their problems, when the rage comes up, then it's very often a question of what ties and what relationships you build with people, which direction this rage will, like which discourse this rage will turn. As it's gonna end up as in Ukraine, you know, when the nationalists were there first, and where they're like, hey, the nationalists didn't start the revolution, you know, it was people who were angry. But the nationalists were there like, hey, you know, this is us, the people who were around you, who have this political discourse and stuff. So people are already angry, and I think it's up to us and creating some network with especially people who are having more problems, that, as I said, like people of my color, to make sure that which direction, which discourse their rage will take. And, you know, like then as well, we can in our communities, like in anarchists, like in more like closed communities, building like higher security culture, take care of each other, and just like getting ready, getting healed from what happened, and getting ready for what can potentially happen. Because again, it's not going to be us who probably going to start it. It's going to be somebody who is more angry, more pissed off, who can't, you know, carry the life anymore. And then we should be there, because it's our problem too.
Kind of taking off from some of the stuff you just said, I kind of wanted to put this to you first. But one of the things that was brought up last night, I'm really glad, this is something that I've been talking a lot about, but just kind of the rise of this kind of right-wing reaction, whether it's out fascist, whether it's out, you know, white nationalist or white supremacist. You brought up on the tour that you've met a lot of people talking about how they're fighting against the rise of the Ku Klux Klan again, or certain neo-Nazi groups in the U.S. You brought up the Oath Keepers, which I thought was great, because that's definitely a group that's growing. You know, different militia type groups. Also, just there's kind of like, I would say more mainstream movements like the Tea Party and such in the U.S., but definitely in where you're from, both of you, like there's a growing fascist presence. I mean, how do you have any strategies or anything that you'd like to share, just kind of like how anarchists in your areas have like dealt with this, and like, you know, what we might take away from that? Because it definitely seems to be something that we're going to be encountering more and more in the U.S.
I usually talk about these strategies about the international solidarity against nationalism, which I think is a tool when, you know, as I was saying last night and every night, the tactics which were successful as militant anti-fascism are still important, but they have no use anymore against the nationalist movements and the state fascism which has been growing. When you see parents of your friends or even your former friends being there by thousands, you just can't take sticks to any of you, put balaclavas on and start to beat the shit out of them. Or as you were used to, attack their leader and burn his car down, because that would just make him martyr and put it like on more spotlight, and they would have like more popularity. So we have to change the tactics completely. And to me, the solidarity is not just respond against nationalism, but it can prevent it. And it goes much beyond than to fight against them, which militant anti-fascism does. And again, saying it's still important thing. Like, I don't want to say throw militant anti-fascism away, it's a bad thing. It's still important. But with it, this solidarity as well creates connection between us fighting against nationalists from our positions and immigrants, or, you know, or Roma communities, or people who are targeted, which when you're fighting just against fascists, we were lacking these network, these connections.
Right now, Europe is basically facing the so-called, what politicians call, the biggest refugee crisis. It is true that like the number of people who are fleeing, mostly from Syria, but also from Northern Africa and other destabilized countries in the Middle East, and the number of refugees that are fleeing in the last 2 years, I guess, is actually already bigger than the number of refugees ever was globally in Second World War. So yes, there is a huge influx of people. And the response of a lot of national state was either state fascism that you were talking about, and that came in the combination of radicalization into the right-wing kind of policies in the streets among, you know, so-called non-politicized people. So the question then for my comrades there was, what are we going to do in this situation? In the past, sometimes, you know, people felt very scared to act in solidarity with some people because they didn't want to take agency away from that. They didn't want to speak in their names. But the situation that my comrades understand there now is that if they don't do something, you know, that inaction is basically also a very strong action. And it means that because of the legal constitution of European Union, how they deal with migrants is that wherever you're registered, you're sent back. And since people are coming through Balkan countries up north, trying to reach Scandinavia, Germany, France, and so on, you know, that means if they get stopped on the Slovenian border, they will be sent to Croatia and then to Serbia and then to Macedonia. Macedonia, for instance, attacked refugees on the border with tear gas and, you know, against children, against little babies. You know, they would be sent to Greek concentration camps, which is how European Union was dealing with the so-called problem of the refugees up until now. And then they will be sent back to Turkey and back to Syria. And I said once, you know, and in Syria, the only place that you get sent is to graveyards with a bullet in your head. And so, for my comrades there, the question was, what can they do in that situation to make sure that they are not accomplices in murder, in mass murder, in racism, in nationalism, in closing borders, but rather opening up a space? So what they did was basically they have created blockades on the borders. You know, they have created mutual aid with refugees, and they have, you know, taken courageous actions alongside with them, trying to break through the border, making sure that people can pass, and they have managed to succeed that. And I think that's one of the examples. You also mentioned the example of how they transport. Maybe you can...
Yeah, there is since for my comrades from Central Europe, it's a little bit farther to act like this directly. Some of people take vans or just cars, and they drive down there. This was especially when the most refugees were held in Keleti. That's our main train station of Budapest, Hungary. When thousands of these refugees and these comrades, they drive down there and offer, right, you know, smuggled people through the borders up to the north. Which is, again, like, to me, like, very brave direct action. And, yeah, they're risking, like, it's not legal, but as Ramona just said, like, what we're risking with that, you know, European passports in our pockets is nothing compared to what these people risking themselves of just like getting that right. So I think this is important to realize that not taking an action is already taken aside, and it's the fascist side. And what I usually say that these things, especially people in Balkans, you know, they do it. It's like based on where they live. It's very local, but it's important to see that it responds to very global problem, which we have to face now. And besides that, there is like people doing all these
gathering donations.
Yeah, which on its own could look like charity, but we got to the point when even like there is such a bad situation in Europe that this act in Prague, which went in one squad or social center there, actually hundreds and hundreds of people responded like, wow, this is great, because we were scared that we are in a place where everyone is basically fascist and we know what to do. So already this voice to like start such a small thing breaks the fear, which I think is important. You know, like you might see this like, yeah, this is just a charity bullshit, but I think this breaking the fear and showing people that there is another side, hand in hand together with these direct actions, which Ramona and I was talking about, I think that's the what I call as international solidarity.
Yeah, and that what it means to open up space for other people, you know, because sometimes we can't expect for, I don't know, my mother, you know, who would also like to not to be on the fascist side, like to probably go and do some militant stuff. That's probably the risk that we will have to take, you know.
Right.
But with that, we will open up a space for a lot of other people to then choose their way of struggling against the rising fascism. And I think that should be our task. Sometimes it's not just about countering, you know, the fascist protest. that's, although I am not saying that we shouldn't do that, but also to basically go around our communities and ask, what kind of street do we want to have? What kind of city do we want to have? Do we want to have a fascist city, or do we want to build different kind of values, you know?
I think this kind of ties into the next question, you know, something that again was brought up last night, but like how do, it's kind of this double project of kind of reaching out to, as people said, like, you know, white working class people here in the U.S. that are kind of like seduced by this kind of like underlying white nationalism, whether it's Trump, whether it's kind of the Tea Party, or like groups like the KKK on the extreme right. But also just like overcoming these divisions that we have in society based on race and class and background or immigration status. And obviously, you know, where you're at, you know, that's, you're talking about the refugee crisis. So that's extreme. I mean, do you feel like there's anything that you would like to talk about as far as like how do anarchists kind of like engage in this project, which seeks to bring people together based around kind of shared anger over conditions, but like they come from these extreme different backgrounds and areas, you know, different ways of life. So
I was just responding to this question last night that in, especially in Europe, it's not just a question of, you know, white power middle class or just or middle class, you know. Nazis, they, or nationalists now, which are basically very often the same people, just with new jackets and with little longer hair supporting politicians, they'll always surround behind anyone just to get more voices and more support. So people, and especially, you know, queer communities or Roma community, which is the biggest minority in Eastern Europe, the most attacked communities in past, I don't know, 10 years or whatever. Now some of the Nazis actually attempting to catch them on, hey, you know, you got a Czech passport too. And you as Roma might not maybe have a very good position, but if the immigrants will come, you will have even worse position because they will just, you know, take your jobs or like your social welfare, though there is not any social welfare in Czech. And they try literally to catch even people which their politics are open against, you know, like co-opt everyone to just gather more support. But of course, once the borders would be closed, once the immigrants would be kept outside and the first conflict would come, which would be probably in a few months anyway, we still live in global capitalism and these jerks don't have obvious like any solution to it. They gonna turn their anger against these people who they try to recruit right now. So I think that's why for us it's important to, for me, to fight against that from anarchist position and not just like anti-fascist or not just try to get one group little more privilege, because that always in capitalism means privilege over another group and just temporary, you know, that doesn't bring liberation.
Yeah, maybe I would speak a little bit about the situation where you are finding yourself in an uprising, and you know, and this is so much bigger than numbers that like radical people involved in anarchism or radical politics have. And, you know, and you are surrounded basically with a lot of people who don't necessarily have a libertarian perspective. In my experience, it's actually that those moments are moments where people are very open to new ideas. And those ideas can go either way, you know. Of course, there are like some groups that want to centralize power there, you know, like in terms of political parties or NGOs or unions or something like that. And then there are, of course, people who want to centralize power in, like you were describing, in terms of nationalistic perspective. But I think that space is also open for us. So if we understand those moments as open space in which we can also engage and simply try to give autonomy to other people, but demonstrate what it means to have different kind of values and be openly anarchist about it, and no longer think that just our tactics will save everything as we thought for a long time. You know, we thought that if we expand direct confrontation with the police in hoodies, you know, like that will solve everything, or that if everyone will be, you know, in a directly democratic assemblies doing the consensus, that will solve everything. We are seeing how all of those tactics were already co-opted. I'm not saying that any of those tactics is bad by itself just because it has a tendency to be co-opted, but I think it's very important that we no longer hide who we are in our struggles. This is something that you were talking before, and I think it's not just important in everyday life, but like especially in a moment where, you know, where things get intensified. I remember the Knar uprising, you know, people would recognize us as anarchists, as anti-capitalists, and they would recognize us because we have, you know, at least a decade of struggle behind us, that they know who they were dealing with. We were not someone who just appeared out of the thin air. We did have some context, and that context was our anarchism in our society. And I think that is becoming a significantly important referential point. I'm not saying that by that we should, you know, have the whole world being declared as anarchist, not at all. But I think we can be important point of reference for people. And I think, that's the best way that we can do, like, demonstrate what it means to be against the state. That's not just, you know, anarcho-capitalism who is also against the state, you know, that brings together different ideas, what it means to fight different forms of oppression at the same time, and building much more freer and radically equal society.
Yeah, there, I would like to add that this is exactly what we were talking about, and I was just reading article and realizing Nazis actually very often, nationalists or state fascists would very often tend to have similar language as we do, or to even intentionally try to steal our language, our image, to use it for there. So if we don't talk openly about the higher horizons, about anarchy or total liberation, or like anti-capitalism and all these, you know, like anti-hierarchy structure, we can fall into making people very confused. Because they speak, our comrade from Brazil always says, like, yeah, we are fighting on the streets, and then there were these dudes who were, you know, starting to beat all the people from political parties. And then we are there anarchists, and we are like, we hate political parties, but hold on, we hate fascists too. Sure, what we should do, because they're fighting political parties because they want to have military dictatorship. They don't want to have multiple political parties.
Right.
I was just reading the article last night where this bastard from Czech, like, he's called Okamura or something like that. It's funny, he's half Japanese, but being very, very racist. He made another thing that I like the demonstration we had, and we say open no to European Union, which is one of the things which is now all over Europe the nationalists and fascists are talking about, to split from European Union, which for me as anarchist, I don't support European Union, but again, like, their support is have a stronger state than to be in union, to be out of it, to be autonomous. That's another thing, like their language of autonomy, which they called us. To me, I'm as well autonomous, but from different perspective. I don't want European Union because I want to have stronger state. I don't want to have European Union because it's a union of many states, and I don't want to have no state, you know, no borders. For them, it's the stronger borders. So that's, even if people not necessarily like would agree with everything, with all tactics we do or all ideas, I think that's why it's important to say it, because otherwise we're just falling into confusing people a lot. Confusing them, like, hold on, the anarchists fighting against the same things, they saying the same things, or maybe not the autonomous there and autonomous there, but okay, so now we have like two groups of autonomous, but that one is bigger, so let's join that one, you know, because people don't see the difference if they never came across anarchism before.
I think this kind of brings up an important question, and this kind of cuts to like the project behind To Change Everything. It's like, so if anarchism is more than just like a mode of fighting, which can be co-opted, I mean, no one owns the patent on direct action or street fighting, like either in moments of revolt or outside of it, like how do we kind of talk to people about, like, you know, as you said, the broader horizon, you know, we don't necessarily have a blueprint, but we have these principles and ideas largely about how we want to organize our struggles, organize our lives, and then ultimately like build a better world. So, I mean, do you have any ideas? Because, I mean, this is something that we talk about in Oakland a lot, too, and, like, go through. It's like, you know, do we hand out zines and stuff at, you know, when stuff's going down? Like, or is that something we do in the downtime? Like, is it bad to try to, like, prophetize, you know, or try to, like, propagandize at different protests and stuff? Is that, like, just what socialists do and we don't want to do that? We just want to be the example. But at the same time, like, those tactics can be picked up and the ideas are just totally lost.
I think that one, you know, when we go out there with our ideas, I don't want to understand them as being propagandists trying to convert people, you know. Mm-hmm. I would like to understand those attempts as opening up a space for a dialogue, you know, where we don't have to end up on the same page, but we can confront and challenge each other's ideas. So I am in favor of creating spaces that can actually have that kind of dialogue. So perhaps are not just handing the zines, but are actually when the zine becomes a tool of discussion, you know, so that we can have like these two or multiple way of communicating. And it's not just one way of, you know, filling people's head with some kind of propaganda. That's for me important. I think to change everything is like a very modest attempt of, you know, people in all over in different continents in more, like I said, more than 27 languages, which means many more countries. And there has been like smaller tours all over the world, like in Latin America, in Slovenia, Croatia, Germany, like all over people are in East Europe, Poland, Czech Republic, Slovakia. People are traveling with this project around, using it as a tool of communication, opening up a space for this dialogue and trying to reach people who are perhaps not usually reached, you know, in a sense that it is important to speak with and challenge each other, you know, in anarchist circles. But it's also important that sometimes, you know, we try to test our ideas with people who are perhaps not anarchists, but are interested in our ideas. And I think trying to figure out this kind of ways of communicating is actually something that it is important. It's not the only thing that we should do, but it's one of the things that we can do.
And I'm just going to end with just asking, coming out of this, you know, if we never see each other again, like, how do we support each other? Not just like the three of us, like me here, you where you're from, but just like in the grand scheme of things, like I'm thinking right now about there was an older anarchist that was just killed in the bombing in Turkey that happened. It looked like ISIS carried it out. He was like an older anarchist. And these big things happen and it almost just feels like this spectacular thing as opposed to something that we can all kind of like respond to or kind of at least put in our thoughts, and it like, it, you know, encourages us to carry out certain actions. So I'm just curious, like you were saying, like, for instance, like when something happens in the US, you know about it, but when something happens where you're from, I probably won't even know where it is on the map or something like that. So like,
you will, I'll be sending you emails now every day.
But I guess what I'm saying, like beyond that, like, how do you think, I mean, just when you think about it in your head, how we should be basically responding to each other and like working closer together, or at least being able to support each other in like in thought and action and in infrastructure.
I like this this poetic way how our comrade from Brazil really say that. It's like let's keep sending smoke signals to each other so you can see them.
Yeah. You know, when uprising was happening in Slovenia, you know, we got a lot of, maybe not from US calls, you know, because we didn't know where Slovenia was, but we definitely got calls from all over Europe, you know, saying, our friends saying, hey, you know, like, we see what's happening. What can we do to help? Do you need, like, an article? Do you need a banner somewhere? You know, what do you need? And we were, like, you know, a little bit cocky saying, well, why don't you start your own uprising, you know, and get some pressure off us? And, I mean, there's, like, it was kind of a joke, but also a reality. I think all of those things, you know, that are usually the kind of solidarity. Sometimes we simply need money, you know, to pay for the cost of getting people out of jail. Other times, you know, just to feel when you are in a struggle, very deep in a struggle, you know, to see that on the other side of the world, someone has put up a banner and is thinking of you, you know, like that actually helps. And sometimes, you know, spreading the word, like if we have those connections and if we hear, you know, that there is something happening and trying to somehow send that message to other people, you know, like in form of article, that is also a very important thing. But most importantly, I think we have to seriously engage in our political projects, because that is actually what inspired everyone, you know, like when we saw, you know, Seattle burning, like we all wanted to have our own Seattle, you know, when we saw Ferguson burning, we all started to think what it means to be in solidarity, you know, with more targeted groups than us. And so many of those moments, you know, when Arab Spring was happening, when Occupy was happening, like so many of those things are actually inspiring us to take actions of our own. And I think that is also the best kind of solidarity. We have to create a situation that will be uncontrollable on a global scale. And that doesn't mean that we all come to one place, but it means that we fight decentralized, just the way the power is fighting against, and the authorities are fighting against us in a centralized way.
Yeah, it's like, as we were saying the day, a few days ago, like when, you know, Seattle happened, and then year after the protest in Prague was happening, which was I believe, inspired by that. And this was the wave of what was happening in this anti-globalization movement, when you can just see the inspiration from one by from each other. But I think as well, when saying that the local struggles and resistance are responding to big global problems, it's not necessary that you always have to find how you're gonna heal here the problem in there and there, but to see things globally, to me is as well, so I was saying, to see my struggle as making sure that it's a part of, you know, being in solidarity with struggle of different communities who are living maybe in the same street or in the same house, because that's very important, you know, like to give my solidarity and show that my struggle is part of everyone else's struggle in the same street, in the same town.
Okay, I just want to thank both of you for joining us here. This is two people that are part of the Crime Things to Change Everything tour. It's going across the U.S. Is there anything you want to say in closing? Just any shout-outs you want to give or any projects that you want to tell people to check you out at, or anything you want to say to anybody on the tour that you've met or anybody that might listen to this?
If you hear this and there's still dates left which you might appear on, if you bring in a vegan food, we'll very appreciate that.
And keep up all of your struggles. I think that touring, we are now halfway through, I think. We have crossed the country from East Coast to the West Coast. And the thing is that we have been deeply inspired by the struggles here. And we are hoping that this will continue to happen, that we will be hearing stories that will be a great inspiration to us in our struggles. And we are hoping that you will be creating many more inspirational struggles here in the US.
Yeah, really. And besides, thank you for inviting us here. Big thanks to everyone who put up and went and came to any of the talks we had to have any discussion with us, because it's been really amazing and inspirative every single night.
Thanks so much.
In a climate of media consolidation, where depth and diversity are increasingly hard to find, we need what independent community radio on 103.3 Asheville FM provides. Your support makes community radio possible. Support diversity right now. Click the donate button on ashevillefm.org or call 828-259-3936 and make a tax-deductible donation to Asheville FM today.
If you appreciate The Final Straw and want to make a donation to Asheville FM, please mention our show in the memo of your donation. $1 to $100 or whatever, no donation is too small.
You're listening to WSFM LP 103.3 in Asheville, North Carolina. This is The Final Straw, and I'm William Goodenough.
And I'm Bruce Goodness.
The show can also be heard on KXCF in Marshall, California, KWTF in Bodega Bay, California, KOWALP in Olympia, Washington, and WCRSLP in Columbus, Ohio. The show will later be archived at thefinalstrawradio.noblogs.org, and you can email us with questions or suggestions at thefinalstrawradio@riseup.net. If you care to, you can send us letters at The Final Straw, care of Asheville FM, 864 Haywood Road, Asheville, North Carolina, 28806. The show is brought to you by Firestorm Books and Coffee. Located at 610 Haywood Road, Firestorm Books and Coffee is a worker-owned cooperative in Asheville specializing in offbeat, underground, and independent literature. Firestorm's full catalog of books and zines can be found online at firestorm.coop.
The Final Straw is still soliciting artwork to put onto tote bags, t-shirts, stickers, small dogs, and more things. If you have an idea or an image, send a link to The Final Straw Radio at riseup.net. Also, our show is free to stream and download. If there's a pirate broadcast or community radio station in your area that you'd like to hear us playing on, shoot us an email at thefinalstrawradio@riseup.net, and we can look into helping to get us onto your local airwaves. If you're listening live right now, stay tuned for Poetry and Pedantics with Wordplay, starring Lockie and Jeff. We're going to close out this episode with Prideme Zinovu by Gattaca off of their self-titled album. Gattaca is from Prague, Czech Republic, and is currently touring Northern Europe. If you happen to find yourself in Leipzig, Germany, they'll be playing at Zorro on the 21st of November.